It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a WPR News reporter who's covering a forum tonight for Democratic candidates for Wisconsin's Attorney General.
First, we're starting our three-day series on heroin use in Wisconsin. Heroin is a highly addictive, illegal substance that can be snorted, smoked, or injected. And many people think heroin addiction is only a problem in big cities or in desperate dark alleys.
But the drug has found a new home in Wisconsin's small towns and suburban communities. Users aren't the hardened addicts of popular imagination. According to State Department of Justice statistics, there are often teens and young adults in Wisconsin who may turn to heroin after forming an addiction to painkillers. Prescription drugs like oxycodone and hydrocodone are getting harder to find and are expensive. Heroin is relatively cheaper and easier to come by.
And the problem in Wisconsin is getting worse. The number of heroin cases processed by state crime labs has steadily increased in almost every Wisconsin county over the last 3 years. The number of heroin-related deaths is on the rise, too, going up 50% in the last year and quadrupling since 2007.
We have two guests with us today to put a face on the heroin problem in Wisconsin. One is Nathan Komp, a journalist and recovering heroin addict himself. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Karen Hale is with us, the mother of a woman who died from an opiate overdose. Karen, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Nathan, let's start with you. You've written about your experience with heroin for the Wisconsin State Journal. We've got that piece linked on our Facebook page. You're a writer. You've got a career going, a college-educated person. How did you find yourself using heroin?
I first used it back in 1999. Same story you've probably heard a million times. Got started on the painkillers. I was dating a girl who was having some medical issues, and the doctors were prescribing her lots and lots of pain meds, and we started hitting those, and then her issues cleared up, and by that time, we heard for the pills quite a bit, and they were really hard to come by back in like the late 90s. Like, they weren't real popular like they are now, and so we made the transition to heroin, and last year was sort of the same story. Kind of started hanging out with, met people who were into the pills, and kind of started dabbling with them for old time's sake, and just snowballed real fast.
And in both cases, the original and the relapse, it was that easy to go out and find heroin when the prescription drugs were too expensive or too hard to find?
Yeah, I mean, it takes a little work, but, drugs, if you're looking for them, you'll find them. They're not that hard to find.
And then, Karen, let's bring you in on this. Your daughter, Alyssa, died from a drug overdose. What was the story? How did she first start using heroin?
Just like Nathan, on prescription drugs, and then it escalated to the heroin. When the pills became hard to come by or expensive, the easiest and the cheapest thing is heroin.
And she was actually prescribed the pain medications originally, right?
That's correct. When she had her wisdom teeth taken out, they gave her a 30-day prescription of oxycodone.
Looking back now, Karen, when did you start seeing red flags that your daughter was using heroin?
Almost like immediately after she had the wisdom teeth out, I saw a change in her behavior. I mean, as a parent, it is the most horrific and gut-wrenching experience that you'll ever go through. The behavior was so volatile. Her behavior, it changed like overnight. Everything was blaming me. She, stole from me. She lied. And because her job became finding the drug. And unfortunately, when the pills became very expensive, then, like I said earlier, the next best thing is heroin. It's cheaper. With us being a border town, it was readily available and easily attainable from Minnesota.
Nathan, when did it first hit you that you weren't just trying heroin, you were addicted to it?
It came when, my girlfriend and I, we kind of knew, I don't know when that exact moment hit. It's real insidious, and it just kind of, hits you one day that, I can't get through my day without this. And we were living in New Mexico at the time, and you know, we left New Mexico because the heroin problem out there is just really incredible, and went up to North Dakota thinking that would be a better spot for us. We got jobs up there, and that turned into an even worse situation because of the oil boom. And then, you know, we just kept finding, trying to find anything, pills, heroin, whatever, up until, you know, when I found Sarah that night. And
as I've
just kind of always knew.
Yeah, as I've heard from other people, Nathan, at some point you're not taking heroin or the other drugs because they're enjoyable. You're taking them to stop the pain of the withdrawal. What happens if you don't take them? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that level of enjoyment. I mean, that's kind of, you know, what lures you in the first place. Is like you feel good, you know, and you know, like the pills get really expensive. I mean, you know. 30 milligram oxycodone is $30, you know, it's like $1 a milligram. And, you know, before you know it, you need 100 milligrams to just kind of, you know, normalize. And you know, the heroin's a lot cheaper.
And as
what was
you,
the question again? I'm sorry.
That's okay. As you write, Nathan, you and your girlfriend had rules that you try to follow along the way. Only take it when the other one was there or different things like that. Did it make it feel safer?
It did. I mean, we really managed to trick ourselves real well into thinking that, you know, like, you know, we'll be clean about it. You know, we'll always use clean needles. We'll always, you know, use alcohol swabs. We'll, you know, use saline instead of tap water. And, you know, we'll, you know, pay attention to the potency when we pick up, you know, new stuff. And, yeah, and the big thing was to not use alone because, you know, if you turn blue, you know, you want there to be able to give you Narcan to bring you back. And so, you know, slowly, you know, it just became... You know, our work schedules would overlap and, you know, we would, you know, be hurting. So we would, you know, fix up and get well and go about our day.
And Karen, going back to you, your daughter, as you mentioned, her behavior changed, her attitude changed. But at one point she approached you and asked for help with quitting. What was it like? How did that process go trying to help her quit?
Well, unfortunately, at that time, I found out we didn't have health insurance. And so... You know, it's a hidden disease, right? Who do you call as a parent? You know, I didn't want to go out on websites, or I tried to go out on some, you know, there's Facebook sites, but I didn't know if my privacy would be, you know, exposed. So I called into the county, and basically it was like, come in for assessment. Alyssa didn't want to go. So I tried to detox her out of the house, which was probably the worst decision looking back now. But at that time, I didn't know what other resources was out there. So I tried to detox her from the house, and it was like a true exorcism. I mean, she was vomiting. She was screaming that it felt like someone was pulling her hair right out of her scalp. It felt like someone was ripping her skin off of her arms, her legs, you know, trying to keep her legs from being set because they were so unsettled. And that's part of that dope sickness or the withdrawal piece off of it. You know, I was so ignorant. Sitting back and looking at what I know today compared to what I know then, when you're in the tornado of addiction, I think you're so isolated and you don't know who to contact and where to go for help. And unfortunately, any type of treatment center for Alyssa was $38,000 or X amount. And unfortunately, they don't do a payment plan. You know, it was cash money right then. Well, I just didn't have that readily available cash to try and get her in some form of treatment. She did get some detox. She went into January or December of a year ago, went in for 5 days. And when she walked out, I thought, okay, she's fixed. We can move on with life. But that wasn't the case. And that's not how this drug just takes and holds so much onto the individual, on the addict.
Nathan, were there points where you tried to quit, and what kind of help did you find out there when you were looking to quit?
You know, we tried to quit all the time. I mean, anytime we saw somebody overdose, we were like, this is it, this is, we're done, you know, and you know, we might go a couple of days, you know, especially if it was like a weekend and we didn't have to work and we could just kind of, you know, suffer it out. But, you know, we would end up buying Suboxone, which is kind of like an alternative to methadone. It's a doctor can prescribe it to you, so you don't have to go to a clinic every day. And so on you know, the times we didn't have money or, you know, we couldn't find anything, you know, odds were we'd be able to find at least Suboxone. So, you know, we would, you know, at least not have to go through the withdrawal. So, you know, whenever we traveled, we'd always travel with Suboxone or whatnot. In terms of getting into a doctor, it was really difficult because there's such a demand out there for Suboxone right now in the federal government. Previously limited doctors to 30 patients. So I think they've increased that now to up to 100. But it was, in New Mexico, we called every Suboxone doctor in the northern part of the state, and every one of them had at least a 6 to 9 month waiting list. So help was incredibly hard to come by, and we both had health insurance.
We're talking to two Wisconsinites whose lives have been touched by heroin addiction and who've both lost people they loved to heroin. Nathan Komp, a journalist, he wrote about his experience with heroin for the Wisconsin State Journal. And we have Karen Hale, the mother of a young woman who died from an opiate overdose.
And so we're asking you, has your life been affected by heroin addiction? Have you struggled with heroin use, or has someone close to you been in that situation? How does it affect your relationships? How does it affect your life? Call in and share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now with Nathan Komp, a journalist and recovering heroin addict, and Karen Hale, the mother of a woman who died from an opiate overdose.
And you can join in. Has your life been affected by heroin addiction? Or someone in your family, maybe. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But I want to talk to Nathan and Karen about why you are telling the stories of yourself, Nathan, and your daughter, Karen, and what we can get out of that. Karen, first, you have, since your daughter passed away, been active, and you've actually been working with other people who are addicts now, right?
Right, that's correct. It's, you know, today is sitting 10 months today. I lost my daughter. And, you know, the pain doesn't get any better and it doesn't get any easier. You know, I think my advocacy started with just trying to educate myself about this deep, dark, secret world that my daughter was in. You know, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't know. So, you know, my quest is if I can help one parent, one other person that is going through this, not to experience this most excruciating pain of losing a child, and to help educate, you know, along the way, I'm educating myself too, but I'm also learning about that private world of my daughters. And that's really what this started. You know, living in Hudson, we had a Hudson Forum to educate the public because, you know, everyone didn't realize what was going on. I mean, we lost 7 young people, one right after the other. And it was time for people to stand up, to open their eyes, to break the stigma associated with this disease of addiction to opiates and heroin.
And Nathan, you shared a very personal story, lost people, including your girlfriend in North Dakota. Why did you write this piece for the State Journal? What are you hoping the rest of us get out of that?
You know, I actually wrote it for my website initially. I broke my ankle in January, and I was just kind of sitting around, and then Phil Seymour Hoffman died, and it just kind of brought a lot of things back. And, you know, I just kind of rattled it off. It was the two-month anniversary of her passing, and, you know, her and I were really isolated for the last year of her life, being in New Mexico and in North Dakota. Like, none of her family or friends really knew what was going on. They suspected, but they didn't really know. Didn't ask a lot of questions, even after I came back to Madison after she passed away. You know, it was just kind of to get off my chest, and then, you know, just kind of grew wings and resonated with people, I guess.
Well, we've got other people with stories on the line now. Sue is with us in Brookfield. Sue, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. And hi, Nathan and Karen. And Karen, I'm so sorry for your loss. It's been a great fear of mine as well. My son has been addicted for many years, and heroin is his choice. Even though he will use anything that's available, he started at 14, you know, smoking pot, and from there it just escalated. He's now 29 and has been on and off What I'm wondering is, as a parent, to actually just save myself, I had to step out. There was just nothing left that I could do to help him. And Nathan, as someone who's been through it, and Karen, as a parent, do you, either of you, have thoughts of anything that we as parents can do to reach that child? I can't reach him anymore.
Sue, I'm sorry for that story. And Karen, do you have, first of all, do you have advice or at least thoughts for Sue?
You know, I walked through that helpless and hopeless, you know, because, you know, you want to give them that cure or that help on a silver platter. And it just, you know, until the person wants to help, you know, that was like with Alyssa. I tried everything. So I wish I could give you a magic wand and say, here, you know, this will help the problem. You know, I don't have the answer. And unfortunately, I know a lot of moms out there that aren't like you and like myself for so many months and years that I went through that. You know, and I apologize that I can't give you that silver lining. All I can say is just hope and pray that your son, you know, knows that he's loved. Just continually say, you know, what can I do to help you? Not financially, not, but what can I do? Or just, are you ready for treatment? Are you ready to get clean? You know, I used to tell my daughter, you've been so good at this addiction. Why don't you try being sober? And, you know, that's all I could do.
And Nathan, is there something that someone, a parent, a loved one could have done to help reach you, to help you out of addiction?
I struggle with that. You know, Sarah and I went back and forth so many times, you know, we both knew we needed to quit. We knew things weren't headed in a good direction. But it's scary when you reach that point where, you know, you can't do it by yourself or even together. You know, the prospect of getting clean for some reason, it's really scary. The depression that follows, the pains, the humiliation, you know, everything that goes along with it, it's just hard, you know. And then you got the people, you know, you're using friends who, you know, continue to call, and, you know, it's hard. It's really, really hard. I've got about going on 3 months now, and it's really not that much easier than that first day. It really isn't.
Thank you so much for the call, and good luck. We'll go to Chris in Oshkosh now. Chris, hi.
Hi. There is a certain amount of help available for people, particularly if they have family members that are supportive and can help them with transportation and stuff. Milwaukee has 100, Salvation Army in Milwaukee has 100-bed facility, and that's free, 6-month to 1-year program. Usually takes about that long to transform the psyche, for lack of a better word. Every major city has these centers, Salvation Army centers, but the best thing is, of course, get a person into detox and get them detoxified and get them into some sort of a treatment while they're somewhat sober, and sometimes that'll take. It's a vicious thing. I'm alcoholic, I understand it, and other substance abuse, but I've been free now for about 35 years, and I worked down there as a volunteer. And you do see results, and you do see people restored to wholeness, and it's independent of any funding whatsoever on the person's part.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing those tips. In major cities, not necessarily where we need them in Wisconsin now, though. In rural areas and suburban areas, we're seeing more heroin use. Just a little bit of time left. Briefly, Karen, anything that you want people to know that they might not know about heroin use?
Well, you know, it doesn't necessarily start with a needle. You know, like you mentioned earlier in the program, snorting, smoking, you know, Alyssa started that way. She started snorting it. She started smoking it. And then when the needle came into place, that's when, you know, the whole thing exploded. You know, I've talked to a lot of the kids out here, and, you know, they are racked with guilt. It's not, you know, I tried to understand, you know, my daughter's behavior because of, you know, the theft and different things. And I think Nathan also, you know, tackled on it. After a while, your friends that you used to have that you don't use with, they turn their backs on them. And I would say to anyone listening, if you have a loved one or a friend that is using, reach out to them. Because you know what? They want to know that there's people out here supporting them. Just reach out and say, what can I do to help you? Because I know Alyssa, when she became sober for the 64 days, that was her biggest heartbreak, is all the people that turned their backs on her. And she so desperately wanted true friends that could support her in her sobriety. I think that would be the message.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Karen Hale and Nathan Comp for coming on the air with us and sharing their stories as part of our series on heroin in Wisconsin.
Tomorrow on our series, we talk to Wisconsin State Representative John Nygren, who has sponsored several bills on heroin in Wisconsin and whose daughter has struggled with heroin addiction.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a philosopher says our online data is a part of our personal identity, so we should take online surveillance by the NSA and others very personally.
First, we're talking about the Attorney General race here in Wisconsin. This is the first open Attorney General election since 2002, and so far four candidates have entered the race, three Democrats, one Republican.
Tonight in Madison, there is a forum for the Democratic candidates, and WPR News reporter Gilman Halstead will be attending. Gilman's on assignment right now, but he spoke with Rob earlier this afternoon about tonight's forum and the Attorney General race in Wisconsin.
Gilman, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here again.
So a forum tonight. All the candidates, I believe, are invited. Who is going to show up at the event tonight?
The three Democrats are going to be showing up. That's John Richards, Representative John Richards, and Susan Happ, who is the district attorney in Jefferson County, and Ismail Ozan, who is Dane County District Attorney. Those are the three Democrats, and they'll be at the forum tonight.
And so far, at least just one Republican announced candidate in this race.
That's right, and I don't think we really expect there to be more than that. Brad Schimmel, who is the district attorney in Waukesha County, was invited. He's not going to be coming, which is not that surprising, I would think, in a race like this, where the Republican candidate in this case would probably much rather let them fight it out and then decide and figure out who he's going to run against.
It would be weird to be the odd candidate out,
yes,
in a way, with the three from the other party there. You might just be a punching bag in a
right
way. So this is Wisconsin's first open attorney general race, no incumbent running, I gather, since 2002. Is this getting a lot of attention around the state?
I think it is, yeah, because the current attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen, has really put his mark on this office in the time that he's been there. He's been really aggressive in a number of areas in terms of the crime lab and in trying to reduce internet crimes, sex crimes against children, and a range of things, an emphasis on open government and the enforcing the Sunshine Laws. And now what's going to happen when he's gone with those kinds of initiatives? I think people are interested.
And tell us a little bit about the three Democratic candidates, first of all. You gave us their titles. What do
right
we know about them?
Well, Ismail Ozan has been district attorney in Dane County. I'm actually not sure how long now, 3 or 4 years anyway. And I guess the things about him that might be most interesting is that he got a lot of attention when he sued the legislature over the open meetings law around Act 10.
Right.
So he has a sort of record of attacking the current powers that be in that sense. He's African-American, and he is really concerned about reducing racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And I guess one other thing we might add is that he and one of the other, the Republican candidate, actually have acknowledged having drunk driving offenses when they were in their youth. Brad Schimmel, as also that became an issue early on. I think it probably won't continue to be one.
Now, Peg Lautenschlager, when she was in
right
office, had that
ironically
issue. But that was a case where she was actually the attorney general then. So that was maybe something that dragged her campaign, maybe
right
led to her losing in her primary.
Right, right. And it almost certainly did lead to her losing that. But drunk driving at the same time will be an issue in this race in terms of the laws that have been being passed and the record that each of these candidates have when it comes to dealing with drunk driving offenses in their jobs as district attorneys and lawyers.
And, well, let's meet Susan Happ now, another candidate in that Democratic primary.
Right. Susan Happ is the district attorney in Jefferson County. And she got her I think all of these candidates got their law degrees here at UW-Madison. And she is, I think, the youngest and the one who's had the least experience. She's been the elected DA since 2005, won re-election in 2008 in Jefferson County, and is emphasizing her, I found in her announcement, her perhaps ability to reach across the aisle, but also perhaps to do a better job of defeating a Republican, because she's the only elected Democrat in Jefferson County, and she's been reelected.
Okay, and she's been endorsed, I gather, by Emily's List.
Yeah, that's the big news this week, that there's going to be some money flowing her way because she's been endorsed by Emily's List that raises money for female candidates around the country.
And then you mentioned John Richards, the remaining Democratic
candidate.
John
Richards is the representative, state representative from Milwaukee. He's been in the legislature since 1998. He's had maybe a little bit less prosecutorial experience than some of the than the others, although he did serve in the Kenosha County DA's office before he became a legislator.
And then on the Republican side, their one candidate. Can you give us a taste of where he's coming from?
Brad Schimmel has been the Waukesha DA for quite some time, and he has championed a lot of sort of innovative work in terms of dealing with drunk driving in particular and creating these victim impact panels. He's very concerned as a prosecutor in defending and promoting victims' rights of all kinds, but that's one of the things. And in a recent Q&A with other reporters, he's emphasized that he's concerned about federal overreach. He singled out this thing that has to do with the Affordable Care Act, that he opposes the ability of the federal government to tell church-run hospitals that they have to cover abortions in their insurance policies.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the job these four are going after, the attorney general job. A lot of times it's referred to as the top cop of Wisconsin. Is it more accurate to say it's the top lawyer of Wisconsin?
Yes, it is the top lawyer. I think it gets the top cop label because the emphasis, especially during campaigns, is their role in convicting criminals and supporting district attorneys and prosecuting criminals. But certainly they do a lot more. They defend state laws. That our current attorney general has been doing that in court recently in terms of the or his office has in terms of the voter ID mm-hmm. law and in terms of this this abortion law as well that's requiring doctors to perform abortions to have admitting privileges at least within 30 miles. So they're defending state laws and often handing down opinions, which are not like Supreme Court opinions, but their interpretation of a law and how it should be enforced.
The campaign will cover a lot of the prosecutorial issues, as you just mentioned, but the things, those items you just mentioned, things like Act 10, voter ID, abortion, whoever's the next attorney general is going to be asked to weigh in on these issues again right. and again, aren't they?
Yes, and it's even that's going to come up tonight in the forum among these three Democrats because they have all in their sort of campaign announcements recently talked about their commitment to the right to vote, the right to marry, which is now also the gay marriage amendment is now being challenged in federal court, and choice, a woman's right to choose. Mm-hmm. Those three are being emphasized, I think, by all three of these candidates. But whether or not they will now stop defending those laws, nobody has really come out and said that.
Is this a race that's going to be overshadowed by the marquee race, the run for governor?
I think to a certain extent, yeah. I think it will be second, it'll be second to that one. But I think it will still be a very exciting race because whoever comes out of this race between the three Democrats, I think are going to be very aggressive in trying to get a Democrat into the Attorney General's office.
All right. Well, we'll be checking in with you again and again on this one, I'm sure, Gil. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR News reporter Gilman Halstead. He joined us to talk about Wisconsin's Attorney General race. There's been a steady stream of news in recent months about how vulnerable our online data is, from surveillance by the NSA to criminal identity theft to exploitation for commercial gain.
Recent surveys show that many people aren't happy with the way their online data is being used and abused. But our next guest says we should be more worried than we are, that we should take it personally because our online data is part of who we are, part of our identity. Colin Copeman joins us now. He's assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon and a resident scholar at the Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics. His recent piece on InfoPolitics is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Colin, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Do you think we take intrusions on our online data seriously, or do we just kind of pay attention when it's out there in the news and but not really lose much sleep over it?
I think it's more the latter, and that's really my concern that I tried to get across in the piece in the New York Times. That a lot of people are, when they hear of these revelations, such as everything that Snowden brought out last summer, were initially very alarmed, and people react in quite serious ways. But then, within a day or two, it seems to be back to normal. And we've got this sort of interesting ebb and flow going on since last summer because there seems to be new reports coming out of the Snowden papers every week or two at this point, right? So I think people have a sense that there's something going on that they ought to be concerned with and something going on that we ought to be, if not downright frightened of, at least wary of, that we ought to be giving more attention to these issues. But part of where I'm coming from in this issue as a philosopher is I think that people don't really have a good sense of how to put their finger on exactly what's going on. And I think there's a deep philosophical question here about exactly what is wrong with the new levels of surveillance that we're seeing.
Right. Part of the thing is people feel a distance, I think, from that data. It's something out there mostly affecting other people, affecting me just a little bit. You're making the case in part that the data out there is us. It's who we are. Why is our online self part of our personal identity?
Yeah, so I guess one of the most common arguments that that we hear as to why we shouldn't be too concerned is that, well, I've got nothing to hide. I'm doing everything right, so I don't mind surveillance because it doesn't affect me. It's not going to really affect me. And I think that kind of attitude, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's rooted in conceptions of selfhood and ways in which we've seen our identities throughout much of the 20th century. But I think there's been a big shift in identity over the last few decades that would suggest that we really are much more intimate with our data and our information than we're used to thinking. And I think one of the sort of, again, philosophical or conceptual difficulties here or challenges here is that this is really unprecedented in human history, right? So it's not bred into our DNA, for instance, to think about ourselves in terms of information and paperwork and digital trails that are aggregating around our lives. And it's not even really built into a lot of our institutions and our moral thinking and ethical frameworks that we've developed over the last few hundred years, because a lot of this stuff, the digital paper trail and just the physical paper trail, is remarkably new. So my idea, and it's not just my idea, and a number of people are beginning to make this kind of argument, is that our information in part constitutes who we are. So I call this informational persons. We've become informational persons. So that doesn't mean that we're just informational persons. My idea is not that, well, information has completely colonized our identity and there's nothing else to us, that we don't have bodies anymore and we're just pure information. You do find people saying that. I think that's going too far to the other extreme. My thought is just that whatever else we are, we're now also our information. We are our information, too. And one way I like to think about that is just posing a relatively simple thought experiment. Imagine that you woke up tomorrow and all of your personally identifying information had been ripped away from you, and you couldn't live within the framework of that information anymore. So your name, your social security number, all the numbers and pieces of identification around you, your health records, your education transcripts, et cetera, et cetera. And not just imagine that all that stuff is ripped from you as if, well, maybe you lost your wallet or something, or had a fire in your home and all the paperwork burned up. But imagine it was taken from you and you were never able to replace it with any other alternate forms of identification, any other alternate forms of paperwork, right? So that you had to live in the contemporary world without these informational aspects of yourself. So I think most people would find that, if not everybody, would find that extraordinarily disorienting. It's just not possible for us to live anymore without all of this personal information. So we live in a very information-rich ecology.
That highlights a point I wanted to bring up. This isn't just about people who are on the internet a lot creating extra trail. There's this kind of data about us, whether or not we go online at all ever, right?
Definitely. The internet aspect of things and the cell phone aspect of things is obviously a relatively new development, but the construction of an informational person and thinking about ourselves and presenting ourselves to various government agencies, various corporate bodies that we interact with, and just other people in an everyday context, that goes back much further. And you really see the beginnings of the construction of an informational self or a data self as recently as the late 19th century. So in doing my research, I was surprised to find that if you go back much before the 1880s, 1890s, it's really hard to see historically an image of people seeing themselves in terms of their information, right? But today, 110, 120 years later, we all readily see ourselves in terms of our information. And one kind of poignant example of that for me that I came across in my research was just the idea of the name. Okay, so this is something that seems almost sort of taken for granted in a sort of 21st century Western context, that everybody would have one and only one name, and that name would be stable throughout all aspects of your life. So that when I'm on WPR, I'm Colin Copeman. When I'm talking to my students in my class here at University of Oregon, I'm Colin Copeman. When I go home at night, I'm Colin Copeman. When I'm hanging out with my friends or out in the forest, hiking the trails of Oregon, I'm Colin Copeman, right? In all these contexts, that's who I am. But that's something I think we all operate according to that. But if you go back much before the 1880s and 1890s, that kind of idea of a single name across all contexts is not very widespread. You certainly find examples of it, especially in the more upper classes. But the idea that everybody has one and only one name and they kind of have to stick to that, especially as a legal marker across all contexts, that was, to me, surprisingly new, that's only about 120, 130 years old.
Huh. Well, are you looking for, in addition to changing the way we think about ourselves in relation to our online identity, are you looking for policy changes that might try to keep up with this changing world?
Yeah, definitely one of the most interesting angles of this is the policy and law angle. Now, I'm not a lawyer or a legal expert or a policy wonk, but it's I find myself increasingly gravitating there because one sees the problems in their brightest form, I think, especially in the legal context. So interestingly, in terms of concerns about privacy, the problems have tended to show up first in the legal context. So the lawyers have a first glimpse at what's going on. And there are a number of interesting lawsuits going on right now. One organization that's really working hard on behalf of what you might call digital civil liberties or informational civil liberties is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they're online at EFF.org. And they currently have two lawsuits going against the NSA. So these are pretty courageous activists in a lot of ways, right? I mean, they're suing the NSA not once but twice. And they're basically looking not only for policy change, but they're really looking for the establishment of a framework according to which the NSA would be subject to some kind of policy at all. So the Snowden revelations last summer took a lot of people by surprise, but people in the privacy and surveillance communities weren't all that surprised because they've known for at least a good 6 or 7 years, if not longer, that the NSA was conducting mass surveillance. What they didn't know, what most of us didn't know, and what was a big surprise was the extent to which this surveillance was being conducted, as it were, extra-constitutionally, without stringent judicial and executive oversight. And the NSA was just sort of out there doing their thing and not necessarily checking their T's and dotting their I's in a legal way. So a big part of what the EFF lawsuits are about is making sure that there's stringent constitutional protection and stringent constitutional oversight of these kinds of things. And I think that's an absolutely crucial first step, because if government agencies are no longer subject to the Fourth Amendment, protections against unreasonable search and seizure without a warrant, then we don't even really have a basic framework within which to seek policy changes. So the problem right now really is that there's not even, as it were, a policy context in which one could seek new policies, because everything is just so far out there with this.
We'll leave it there for now. Colin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Colin Copeman, assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. We've got a link to a piece he wrote on identity, politics, and the Internet on the Central Time Facebook page.